Well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that I have that I want to preserve, and it's, you know, how much money and effort do you want to put into preserving stuff? It's hard, because then you have to spend money, and then you have to also spend energy in preserving that stuff. Right now, I'm slowly consolidating all of my stuff onto my NAS, and that will be a good backup, but that backup needs a backup. Like, it needs to be somewhere else. My preference would be to have a secondary, like, probably just a good high-quality external hard drive that I can just duplicate everything to, and that'll be the backup that I update and correct with the original, you know, 2 times a year, maybe. The other option is, of course, cloud backup, but that costs money, and I don't like subscription costs. Like, I'd rather pay 10, 100 times the monthly cost of cloud storage to have something I have on my own. Then it's not on the cloud, then someone else doesn't have the ability to access it, and someone doesn't have a steady drip into my monthly payments. Now, the argument against that, of course, is, well, you know, you just pay a token amount of money every month, and it's backed up and saved by someone else, and it's encrypted, so it's still private. But I just don't like that.
I'll say, for me, I just highlight two things there. One is, I hate subscriptions. Subscriptions, to me, are detrimental. And like you said, I'd rather pay all of the money up front and be done with it, even if it's the same amount of money, so that I don't have a small drip every month. Any type of subscription base, I try to avoid desperately.
Yeah, and I might be a little too hardcore in my thinking there. It's just, I really don't like the idea of a subscription, even if it's a small amount that I can afford. I just don't want to do it, because it's like a wound that never gets healed up, in my opinion. And that might be a little too dramatic. And of course, I say that, but I do have some subscriptions in my life. The only one that comes to mind right now is Patreon. Like, there's a few podcasts that I support on Patreon. Hardcore History, of course, the most important podcast there is, and a few others. And that's it. That's it, really.
Well, those, in my mind, don't come across as subscription-based, because I'm supporting something that I believe in.
Exactly, exactly. Like, I want Hardcore History to do well and be a thing for as long as Dan Carlin can do it. And the value I get out of it, and how much I learn from it, and how much it's changed the way I think about the world and the way I think about history. I can't afford to pay what it's truly worth to me and the difference it's made in my life, but I at least pay, you know, a handful of bucks a month to support the work he does.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
And yeah, like you, I don't think of that necessarily as a subscription, even though practically that's what's happening every month.
And in my mind, extrapolating that subscription idea, for me, I often try to lump all of the actions I need to do in one big chunk. Like, if I could, for example, sleep for 7 days straight, and that would be all the sleep I need for the next month or something, I would happily do that. Same with eating, same with everything else. There's almost something in my brain that drives me towards, how can I gather all of the resources I need and get everything done in an efficient manner to free up my time and energy?
Right. That'd be nice in an ideal world. It's just not going to happen.
But I think that is something that drove our ancestors towards an agricultural society, right? Oh, I can just gather all of the food I need, and I don't have to worry about it day to day as much, so long as I put in the time and effort to complete my farming and harvesting and everything else.
Maybe that's part of our reward system. Like, we get rewarded we get a little shot of dopamine for hunting down some berries, hunting down something for dinner. If we could feed that reward system more, why wouldn't we? And that's what drives our progress. Like, oh, this is good, this feels good, and it's increasing my chances of survival. Therefore, let's do more of that.
I mean, our brain is wired in such a way to constantly pursue things that improve our chances for survival and reproduction. That's going to be the baseline drive of everything we do. Now, you could derive that in the way Ernest Becker derives those motives and behaviors to be the denial of death or avoiding death. And whether or not we agree with it, I do think, along with that or beside it, that the drive towards survival and reproduction is a great baseline understanding of not only human motives and actions, but animal and other biological forms, motives and actions.
This is kind of something we talked about in book club this past week for the book we're reading, unrelated to this, but it still ties in with denial of death, in that, you know, is there a benefit, and to what extent is there a benefit to looking for the deeper motive behind some of the stuff we do? Me personally, I'm a little biased towards looking for that deeper level, even though sometimes a more superficial explanation is more than sufficient. But yeah, at the bottom of all of that, I'm convinced, is to alleviate or assuage our fear of death, or preventing or putting off our death for as long as we can.
I would say one of our mutual good friends, Diego, he had a nice way of putting things that helped make sense to me for other people's actions, as well as my own actions, in that we as humans will be metaphorically running. And you can sometimes choose to run towards something, or you can run away from something. But it's typically going to be one of those two motives. And our brains are wired in the same way. We run towards that dopamine drip of the super unhealthy, delicious food, or we run towards the dopamine drip of social media or anything else. But our brain is also really good about running away from fear, pain, discomfort. Without more driven motives, we will oftentimes sink lower to be lazy, relaxed, efficient with our energy, and run away from discomfort. And that's a very natural baseline, not only for humans, and it's okay to call us lazy, but animals are the same way. Given the same access to resources, they will always pursue the lazy or the lowest energy state.
That's just being efficient, following the path of least resistance. And I think you go ahead.
And we see that in the biological world, but also in the inorganic world. So chemistry, or how molecules form, they are always seeking the lowest energy state. That's one of the laws of thermodynamics, of how we're progressing or how we make a chemical reaction happen. Yes, there's a hump of activation energy, but in general, the world is constantly driving towards disorder, low energy state.
Like gliding, like jumping off of a cliff and gliding. You know, what can we do to make that glide last as long as we possibly can? And the fall and touching down is inevitable, but how long can you make that glide last? How long can you drag it out?
I mean, that's a nice zoomed out viewpoint of life. And I believe it was Comfort Crisis that we read, where the author was talking about being in Bhutan, was it?
Yeah.
And how they had this beautiful image when he was talking to one of the Dharmas, that you're taking a hike and you're going to run into a cliff no matter what you do. Wouldn't you like to know that the cliff is there, that you're going to fall off? It doesn't matter. At some point, you're going to fall off that cliff. And if you can zoom out life and look at that perspective of death, then you can set yourself up for better success. And I really liked the way you said it, gliding. So the higher you climb to begin with, the longer you can glide.
Right, which brings us back to our original point, where we're slowly tying in denial of death here, which is ostensibly what we're supposed to be talking about today. This is our second episode on Ernest Becker's Denial of Death, is looking at what truly motivates us.
Bringing all this in, let's go ahead and I'm Joel Serrano.
And I'm Leo Serrano.
And as Leo said, this is going to be our second episode ever. This will be our week two release. This will be our second and last part of Denial of Death, where we will be concluding our conversation about Ernest Becker's Denial of Death and hopefully move on to the next book for the following week. And we will submit that out. So if you want to read it with us, we can read it. But we'll talk about that at the end of the episode. For the beginning right here, we're going to finalize some thoughts and feelings and ideas thanks to the wonderful writings of Ernest Becker.
So, back to what we're talking about. What is the motive underneath our actions? So something as simple as me going and looking in the fridge. There's the superficial reading of I'm hungry, or more likely, I'm bored. Underneath that is maybe a drive to eat, acquire food, prolong my survival, keep that glide going for as long as I can. One way that I see interpreting denial of death would be underneath even that motivation would be, again, to run away from death or get away from my fear of death as soon as possible. And there's those different levels you can operate at. Sometimes looking in the fridge is just looking in the fridge, but to me it's useful to also try to trace a connection as a mental exercise to the fear of death or getting away from death.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I feel most people enjoy trying to understand the actions and behaviors of not only themselves, but other people. And we see a lot of studies and research and people writing books about trying to understand people. And the baseline that you said is there's this action or this observable behavior. And behind that, there's some type of cue, say hunger to go look in the fridge. But we can always derive that further into what the base of that cue is. And the fear of death is a good one that I think encompasses a lot of baseline actions and motivations of human beings.
Right. And maybe a more practical, if someone's having a hard time, like, well, do I really need to trace motivations down to fear of death? Maybe an easier but still deeper level to analyze a motivation at would be to, like, exert control. That I think that's a good level to operate at. So, you know, why, I think an example we spoke about in book club was scrolling. You know, like, you have some hopefully just a few minutes where you're spending scrolling. Often it's more than just a few minutes where you get sucked into scrolling through something on social media, YouTube, whatever it is. And the motivation there at the superficial level would be I'm bored, or I want, maybe let's go a step below that, I want a little dopamine hit. Go a little bit lower than that, go down to the basement, of course it would be fear of death if we're looking at it through the lens of denial of death. But maybe in between those two levels, let's not go all the way to the basement floor, right before that, maybe it's control, closely connected to the fear of death, but wanting to feel like you have control over your life or your situation. There's a term I've heard, I'm sure everyone's familiar with it or has heard it, late night revenge scrolling. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't heard of that. Tell me about it.
Okay, I heard about it recently. People that are more savvy with the internet are like, duh, I already know what you're talking about. But from what I understand, late night revenge scrolling is when you've had a super busy day, you've been careening from one task to another, or you're just tired. Instead of doing the healthiest thing for you in the long term of going to bed on time or a little early, you do a mindless task. You know, in this instance, it'd be scrolling on social media or the internet or whatever. And you do that almost like some revenge, like a part of you is getting some revenge for being beholden to all your responsibilities and tasks you had to get done during the day. Well, I'm going to reclaim some of my time here and scroll a little bit. And, you know, you got to get up and do it all again the next day. And so you're sabotaging yourself a little bit, but it feels good in the moment to exert that control. I get to do this. I get to take over this, you know, handful of minutes or whatever, when really that's not what's good for you in the long run. So late night revenge scrolling. That's my understanding of it. Like, oh, you fall into that temptation easily, and the motivation underneath that is part of you wants to feel like it has control and gets a little bit of dopamine boost after you've had a, you know, grinding day or a hard day.
I've heard and read about similar things in terms of that revenge idea. Someone, a good friend of mine trying to lose weight, they talk about how they'll go eating healthy all day or all week, but then a part of them is like, well, I ate healthy, and they get really mad and upset about it, and then they almost lose the willpower and eat something unhealthy or eat something sugary as like a rebelling against their own superego forcing them to do a good thing. Or like you were saying, you're rebelling against the hard day that you had. I've also, you know, saw plenty of events where like employees would steal an unnecessary thing from the company just because they feel like they're regaining some type of control or aspect. And I think a lot of that, like you said, is wanting to have control over that event or space or yourself. And we always drive towards wanting control. No matter your position in life, most people want respect and control, right? Very few people daydream of like, I can't wait to be, you know, the person in the cubicle that gets told what to do from 9 to 5. Most people have that daydream of like, well, I'm the boss, I'm in control, I choose what happens. And I see that in a variety of people where they try to exert certain control. And I think trauma responses really highlight some of the more extremities. And I've seen some people in my life that had like domestic abuse issues where they were very particular about cleaning or very particular about something that they could control because it made a space in their brain to hopefully make a safe space for themselves. And I know for me, for my personal experience, sometimes I have a hard time in my personal life, personal relationships, or work. And what I go and do is I go work out, because when I go work out, I control that space of, well, I'm going to lift this weight or I'm going to run. And that helps regulate my feelings and emotions, both on a physiological sense because I'm releasing dopamine for myself, but also I have this feeling of like I took my own body and I did this action, which I had control over.
Yeah, you're getting a ton of benefits, but you're consist like during that workout, one of the things that you're doing at a psychological and nervous system level is you're reinforcing the fact that I have autonomy. I can choose to go from point A to point B, from point A to point B, over and over and over again. I get to do this. Therefore, you're convincing yourself, hey, I have control of this situation. So that's one of the reasons why that kind of brings your baseline down. You slow down a little bit and it's calming. Yeah, you burn off excess energy and you get yourself to kind of where you want to be, but also kind of at that mental, physical level, borderline, you're reminding yourself, okay, I have control of my situation.
Yeah, and ultimately, isn't that what we want? Because if we have control, then perhaps we can stave off death. And I think that would be Ernest Becker's idea. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like Ernest Becker talks about, you know, the personal philosophy of people where religion can be used or other things can be used to basically have a denial of death or an avoidance of death or some, he also talks about hero systems of creating something where you won't truly die, But all of these things require you to have control of the space. Because if you don't have control, and what is the ultimate lack of control? It's typically dying, right? We have no control over dying. We might have control over many other things. Maybe we do, maybe we don't. But we all know deep down there is no controlling death. And, you know, I think about the people I met through rescue that looked at me and said, I don't want to die. And in those situations, dealing with patient care or looking at those people, right, I, and every single person, is powerless against death. I can try to stave off death for a little bit longer, and that's kind of our jut with Western medicine typically, especially for paramedics and field medicine and austere medicine, is more or less the base philosophy we have is this person, I will try to keep this person from dying no matter what while they're with me so that I can get them to definitive care. And that is the base, is I will try my best to keep this person alive. Sometimes we talk about life over limb in austere environments, like when we did cave rescue. Sometimes we're going to have to put a risk to you losing that leg, but we're going to try to keep the rest of your body alive. And that's life over limb. And I think about the times when I had those patients look at me and say, I don't want to die. I mean, what does anyone say to that? You know, now it's not, or at those points was not the time to be like, hey, listen, we all die. You might die. Don't worry about it. That's not.
Yeah, that's not helpful.
Yeah, that's not the philosophy they want right now. Because they're having the worst day of their life. And sometimes those situations for me were easier than when one of my partners was taking care of the dead or dying person, and then I'm with the loved one, the husband, the wife, the mother, the father, and they're truly having the worst day of their life, where I have to tell them that we found the body, not that we found them alive. And there's no other way to just give it to them straight that so-and-so is dead. We don't say passed away. We don't say moved on. And this is a good philosophy that we had in Search and Rescue, is we say is dead. We make it clear cut, because there's no other way to just give that to that person.
Yeah. It, you know, on the surface that might be seen as kind of harsh, but you're being respectful to the person who's died and the relatives or the close friends and family, and being respectful and just being honest, being fair to them and their grief. That makes sense. So what Joel's talking about there is he spent a number of years working for Search and Rescue in Blacksburg, Virginia, right? Yeah, pretty extensive search and rescue operation. So you got a lot of close-up experience with death and dying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Going back to that control, who is it that said the only real philosophical question is whether to commit suicide or not?
It's Camus, Albert Camus.
That would make sense. So that's one of the few things we can do, so to speak, to control death, but you're just controlling when it is, not if it happens. And I think that drives a lot of our actions and behaviors.
Well, he meant a few things by that, but we'll get to that when we talk about Camus.
Yes, we can save that for Camus' own episode when we get to his work.
You would like to be able to choose when you die or how you die, ideally.
Yeah, and I think that is also driven, obviously, by the fear of death, because that's the true burden, right, of being a mortal person. And I believe this is Ernest Becker's kind of wording. Of course, everything is paraphrased here, but he talks about how we are a mortal being, but we have an immortal brain, right? Our brain is superseded by our biological structure. We have this mind of seeing the past, seeing the future, wanting to be alive forever, wanting this immortality, and we are basically an immortal being in our brain, but our organic body is and will always be mortal. And that intersection there creates such tension that we have to come up with a solution. And his easy one that he talks about is schizophrenia or other mental disorders in order to deal with that tension.
Right. He brings in mental health issues and looks at them through the lens of the fear of death. And of course, him writing this is looked at more so from a psychological standpoint than from a health standpoint. And he uses at the time a lot of psychoanalytic ways of looking at it. So there's a lot of talk of repression and the tensions there. But yes, he looks at those things through the lens of how they interplay with or could potentially interplay with the fear of death. The one we talked about last episode was narcissism or having a big ego. The way to look at that through the lens of death, broadly paraphrasing what Becker says in Denial of Death, is that that allows us to feel so important that we can't possibly die. Now, someone who is in that situation, of course, knows at some level that they are going to die, but it helps them avoid that fear of death if they are the center of their universe. Like, well, the world revolves around me, therefore I'm not going to die. So it's a paradox that exists in that person's mind, and they're not aligned with being fully cognizant of and facing up to the fear of death. And that's just one of the defenses kind of built for that. Another, I don't know that Becker specifically talks about conspiracy theories, but a lot of people that really get into conspiracy theories, same thing. They get to participate in something much larger than themselves, much larger than their daily lives, and they get to be an actor in a much larger stage, at least in their mind. Another way that people are kind of distracting themselves from the fear of death. Again, just the mental exercise of looking at things we do and motivations at bottom being motivated by a fear of death, distracting from the fear of death, avoiding death. That kind of sums up a bit about control. One thing you mentioned earlier that I wanted to circle back around is we began by talking about how useful is it to look at the bottom motivations of an action or of an impulse. You know, if we go to that bottom basement level of avoiding death or getting away from the fear of death, how useful is that? And I think one argument would be, well, sometimes I'm just doing something to do something, or sometimes the superficial explanation is all it is, or is just good enough. And that reminds me of the image of a carrot and stick. So, you know, you can motivate yourself or someone else or a pet with both, you know, avoiding discomfort or gaining more comfort, like a treat, like training a dog or a cat with a treat. That's would be the metaphorical carrot, dangling a carrot in front of yourself or the animal to motivate behavior in a particular direction, towards a particular direction. That carrot, in a way, is pulling that animal or person forward towards behavior or into a particular behavior. But then there's also the metaphorical stick. And I think if you use both, you're getting two different motivation systems. So if my goal is to, you know, get better at a particular sport or get better at a particular lift or improve a particular skill. If I can see both, if I can have a really good picture in front of me of what I want to move towards and a really good picture behind me or what I want to move away from, and if I can be realistic about the role of fear of death in that, I think that gives you a lot behind you to propel you away from, to move you away from something. So a push and a pull. I think if we have both, we get to benefit from almost two motivation engines.
And if I were to try to distill the things you're talking about here, what I'm hearing as the primary question, presupposing all of what you said, is Ernest Becker's theory useful? Is the denial of death theory useful? And I think you're saying, and maybe you want to use your own words, but I think you're saying, yes, using his theory is useful and we can use it in our daily lives. And it's a valuable thing to help drive the habits we want to form or the actions we want to take or the personal life philosophy we want to carry with us.
To me, yes. To me, you know, I love the book. I love the thought experiment there. I think it would be easy to get lost in the weeds and not see the forest for the trees. It's very easy to overanalyze something and pick something apart. But at a broad level, I think the main thrust, yes, the book and his philosophy is very helpful, especially for me. You know, what I mean by getting lost in overanalyzing is he does bring in a lot of Freudian thought. He brings in a lot of thoughts from psychoanalytic field of thinking and philosophy. And another argument someone might be able to bring to bear against the book is, well, he's kind of shoehorning many, many things into the fear of death. But for me, at least, that would be overanalyzing and just picking stuff apart and kind of missing the whole broader message that he has there, which I think is useful, especially when looked at for what's the practical takeaway here. And a little bit of what we talked about last week is tying his idea of hero systems and immortality projects to good and evil acts. So if you want to participate in a mythological story and be the hero in your own story, if you are very conscious of how much fear of death could be potentially playing a role there, or at least go through that thought experiment, that helps you maybe be conscious about not setting up things to be evil, to be counterparts for the good you want to do. I think that that is where his philosophy would have ended up after denial of death, if he was able to live longer and not be taken by the cancer when he was taken by it. That is what he would have written more about. We know that from what we saw in the introduction and just the bit of his work that we've seen. His next book was going to be about the evil that gets done in the name of immortality projects and hero systems.
Absolutely. And I agree with you that when we take the "is this theory useful" question, your answer is yes, my answer is yes. And I think it's a good way to remove some of the barriers that we might have in our life. And the easiest thing that comes to mind for me is the old TV show Futurama. And one specific episode in it, Bender, who is the robot, he, like other robots, has a backup drive. So when his robot body dies, he can just be uploaded into a new body. And he has this mentality of immortality. But then he finds out that his backup drive is defective and broken. And he's like, how do you, speaking to the humans, how do you deal with, you know, the thought that you're going to die? And Fry, the like comedic relief dumb character, is like, oh, thanks to denial, I'm immortal.
Right. Yeah. That is a perfect summary of Ernest Becker's work.
Right. And the other characters have other questions, and the episode revolves around this robot character dealing with the idea of, I was immortal, now I realize I'm mortal, I'm going to chase down the person that let me be born, so to speak, and take my revenge. But taking back to the idea that, oh, thanks to denial, I'm immortal, I think Ernest Becker is a good intro into taking away that barrier. And we see this in many other books, many other ideas, but taking away that immortality, or that I'm just too busy today, I can't think about death, I have to go to work, I have to take care of my family, I have to do all these things, which are true statements. But if we keep denying or avoiding thinking about death, avoiding that uncomfortable feeling of death, then we're taking away part of our ability to live. And I think Zen Buddhism also looks at some of that in a different light, to take away that fear of death, where they talk about, you know, you just live in the moment. Stop stressing or worrying about the future or the death. Live in the here and now. And so part of meditating is taking away those thoughts and ideas, taking away that immortal part of our brain of wanting to live forever, and just breathing and living in the moment, which is a slightly different answer to the same question of, we're going to die, we have this fear of death, how do we deal with it?
Yeah, what you're getting at there, I think, takes us into the realm of maybe Stoic thought there a little bit, with the concept of memento mori, which I don't recall Becker speaking much about in the book, if at all. But ultimately what he suggests through the book is to be aware of death, face up to it, and use that to help orient your behaviors, is very much in line with how I see the message of memento mori. Remember, you're going to die. And for me, at least, just speaking for myself, thinking about death and thinking about, you know, my eventual not being here to participate in the activities I do and be with my friends and family, to me, helps keep an eye on what's important to me. So it's, for me, just using the example of scrolling, sounds a little silly, but it's easier to avoid the temptation of wanting to scroll on social media if I am thinking about death. Maybe if I had a skull sitting on my desk reminding me, hey, that will be me one day, it'd be a little bit easier to not give into that temptation to remind myself the time I have left is limited, and every unit of time that passes is one more step closer to death. And then the fear of death, of course, would start a dialogue in my brain where I'm like, well, that's a long ways off, but we don't know that. We don't know how much longer we have to live. So it helps keep me oriented towards what's important. And it also helps with, you know, like daily frustrations. One of the benefits of working out is that you handle all the other stressors, at least for me, you handle all the other stressors of the day just a little bit more relaxed, just a little calmer. You're less reactive. When you're have a healthy relationship with your inevitable death, I think that has the same kind of effect. You're a little less reactive to the stuff that doesn't matter, and you can focus on what does matter a little bit more. We're not venturing too far from what Becker talks about here, but that is, I think, branching us out into Stoic thought a little bit.
You talk about that skull sitting on your desk and you look at it, and so you stop scrolling because of it. I would say,
I don't have a skull yet, but maybe I will get one.
Right. And that is your response. Oh my gosh, I will die. Let me focus on what matters. Other thoughts, like Oscar Wilde, would be the hedonistic idea of, oh yeah, I am going to die, so let me drink more tonight.
I think he said life's too important to take seriously.
Yes. And I really enjoy Oscar Wilde's view on life. And in many ways, I do agree with him that sometimes we do stress about things too much. And sometimes you should lean into the pleasures because we will die. And one thing that I've brought with me is our dad. He sent me a little list of things that he talked about for his life philosophy and what he felt like. And one of the things he mentioned was it's okay to splurge on yourself. It's okay to spend a little bit more extra money on an enjoyable thing. It's okay to buy the extra fun package for your family when you go to Busch Gardens. And he had this mentality of, yes, we are going to die, so we need to add the enjoyment. You don't need to be the most disciplined person in the world at all times because we will die. I don't think his philosophy and I know my philosophy does not lean all the way into hedonism where, oh, I'll die, so let me just enjoy all the pleasures of life to the fullest. Because part of the pleasures of life to me is being disciplined and working hard to finish a race or obstacle course or achieve the next grade of rock climbing or do some hard task, because that for me is also the true moments of life. The other thing that you mentioned was that fear of death and remembering that we're going to die. I sometimes sit back and I'm working and I work from home, and sometimes I'll be interrupted by someone while I'm working. And I have to stop and say, Joel, remember that, yes, we're working and we're making money, but the reason we're doing that is so that we can live and spend time with our loved ones. And the true meaning of life isn't me working. And so it is a nice reminder to not get angry or upset or annoyed in those moments, but instead enjoy and revel in those feelings.
Yeah, I worked in the collision repair industry for a while, and that is an industry that can very easily just take every ounce of your time and energy. And I worked with some amazing people, and the thing that I would remind my employees often was that we work to live. We don't live to work. And that helped me and them keep a focus on what people call a work-life balance. I don't really like that term that much, but it does help with that work-life balance. Like, remember what you're describing. That's the phrase that I would have to remind myself and some of my more workaholic employees. We work so that we can live. We don't live so that we can work. And that speaks to that balance between being disciplined, getting stuff done with our limited time, but enjoying the process and remembering what's important. And you bring up a good point. Whereas for me, you know, I could be motivated by that metaphorical skull sitting on my desk. I do lean into, you know, being a little too goal-oriented or goal-focused sometimes. And I have to remind myself, enjoy the journey, enjoy the process. Sometimes I get a little frustrated if I'm not making progress towards a goal, or if I feel like I'm taking too long to get from point A to point B when pursuing a goal or wanting to improve something, when really we need to be conscious of both, balancing being disciplined, pursuing the goals, pursuing the stuff you want to pursue, but enjoying the process. And yeah, you're exactly right. You know, on the one hand, you've got the Stoic skull sitting on the desk and Oscar Wilde. You would be benefited from having both on the desk of your mind. Skull and maybe a picture of Oscar Wilde enjoying a drink or something.
That's a great way to look at it. I think one of the driving fears that Ernest Becker talks about is the brevity. And he discusses the brevity of our mortal body with our immortal mind, our immortal spirit. One of my most recent trips was out to Seattle, and I got to see Bruce Lee and Brandon Lee's grave, his son. Both died young and under odd circumstances, but what I read on his gravestone stuck with me, so I want to read it now. Because we don't know when we will die, we get to think of life as an inexhaustible well. Yet everything happens a certain number of times, in a very small number. Really, how many more times will you remember a certain afternoon of your childhood? Some afternoon that's so deeply part of your being that you can't even conceive of your life without it. Perhaps four or five more. Perhaps not even that. How many more times will you watch the full moon rise? Perhaps 20? And yet it all seems limitless. And I sat there and I really enjoyed Bruce Lee's movies and his son's movies. And he was a great martial artist.
And Dad did too. Dad loved them.
And that's a part of our childhood. And so how coinciding that, you know, on his gravestone, it talks about these memories. How many more times will we think about it? How many more times will we see the moon rise or the sun rise? How many more times will we celebrate Christmas? And it is easy to get lost in that idea of it's an endless well, that it's infinite. We don't think about this really could be the third to last Christmas I ever celebrate with my family.
Yeah, that's maybe a even more poignant and useful reminder of what's important and how we spend our time and how truly limited those remaining events are. There's a really good website. It's been around for quite a while, but it's extremely powerful. We'll find it and put it in the show notes. I'm sorry to whoever site that is or blog that is that I can't remember the name of it right now, but he does a fantastic job of talking exactly about what you're talking about in images. How many more times will you be having Christmas with your family? How many more books will you actually read in your life? And he breaks down, you know, the rough calculations, and he's just got, you know, X number of little images of books in a block. You know, okay, if I'm this many years old and I read this many books on average, and I would be likely to live until this age, that's X number of books per year for this many years. And so he produces the image of here's all the books remaining that you'll read in your lifetime. Same thing with Christmas. How many more Christmases are you going to have with your family? If your parents are still around and, you know, they're getting older and you see them on holidays, if you're lucky enough to see them on holidays, how many more of those are there? And with grandparents, if you're lucky enough to have grandparents still around, how many more family holidays are you going to have with them? How many more times will you go out to dinner with that one friend? That great, great blog. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes, because that absolutely, I think, is a great image for looking at that. One thing you mentioned I wanted to circle back to, And I just want to make sure we're representing Becker here as accurately as we can. I know it's been a little while since we read the book. You were talking about balancing the fact that we are mortal with our mortal spirit. Becker doesn't necessarily talk about immortal spirit or immortal mind that much. I don't think we can double check after the break. But one thing he does point out is that we only have firsthand experience with being alive, with doing things as a living being. We have no experience whatsoever with death or dying. We only know about it from observing it, its presence in our life. And so we don't know what it's like to interact with that or have that. So that's kind of the terror that he points out in Death and Dying, is that we have no experience of it. It's the ultimate unknown because we cannot experience it. That's just a clarification I wanted to make there. Okay. You want to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll wrap things up?
Yeah. Let's go take a break. And we're back. Immortal Mind. To give some clarification, Ernest Becker talks about the symbolic man, which is immortal. And the symbolic man has to deal with the split in between having a mortal body and knowing that we are, in his words, worm food, and being a symbolic non-animal but man, which symbolically wants to be immortal.
Symbolically wants to be immortal.
Yes. And part of, I believe, his reasoning here is that man desires to avoid death forever, that we desire that immortality, or he talks about the symbolic man desiring immortality, that we are immortal in our minds.
If I remember correctly, he takes up the line of thinking with Carl Jung in seeing the way man views the world through symbols and the symbols he creates. The most obvious example would be, of course, the immortality projects and hero systems that we make. That's us living through symbols.
So that friction, which is splitting our mind, is some of the basis for what he argues, especially compounding on psychoanalytical theory up to that time in the 1970s.
60s. 1960s is when he wrote it, but yeah,
yeah, came it was out published in the early 70s.
Yeah. Kind of wind towards an ending here. One of the things glancing over my old notes from reading the book is towards the end of the book, Becker talks a good amount about, he doesn't use this word, but this is the word I like to use for it, ideology. And that builds on what he talks about in the earlier parts of the book, where ideologies and thought systems are very strong things that people cling to because in a way they are immortality projects and ways to prevent us from dealing with our imminent deaths. And the way I'm using the word ideology here is something that you put ahead of facts and evidence. You put evidence and facts in support of a thought system or a belief system rather than the other way around, the opposite of thinking empirically. And in the 60s, when he was writing this book, a lot of what he was working with was based off of Freud's work and psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, everything that was going on during that time period. And one of the images that struck me from the notes was that he talks about there needs to be a resurrection of the body as the primary seat of pleasure, meaning for us to be more grounded in our physical day-to-day lives. What he would use the word creatureliness, for us to be more grounded in what it is to be a physical animal being, dealing with the fact that we have to die and not get lost in ideology and different belief systems, not get so caught up that we ignore the physical, which was a trend he saw in the thinking during his time. Does that make sense? On that line of thought, let me read a little quote here. I believe this comes from the last chapter of the book. Mankind can only transcend the terrible toll that the fear of death takes if it lives the body fully and does not allow any unlived life to poison existence, to sap pleasure, and to leave a residue of regret. If mankind would do this, then the fear of death will not longer drive it to folly, waste, and destruction. Men will have their apotheosis in eternity, by living fully in the now of experience. End quote. Does that make sense? What he's saying there is that unlived life, to not let any unlived life poison existence and sap our pleasure. Meaning if we get so caught up in a belief system, if we get so caught up in an ideology, that we could easily get robbed of enjoying life and having a meaningful life.
Yes. I think one of the quotes I had from the book, which is, guilt results from unused life from the unlived in us, which is exactly the same thing that you're saying, that I believe is some of the pebbles of shining value that we can pull out of it, is he doesn't give a prescriptive answer to the question of the terror of death, but he does provide these things that shine towards what I believe his personal philosophy was, which is that unused life, or that unlived life, or the terror of dying, which can become the terror of living, means that we don't live to the fullest, which would be a more layman way of saying what I believe he was getting at.
Towards the end there of the book, he talks a lot about the limitations of psychotherapy and where it was at that point. Basically, the line of thinking from Freud is my understanding. And again, he didn't use the word ideology, but that's the word that kind of helps me understand it there. Speaking of psychology and psychotherapy, he was saying that it's kind of a philosophical dead end if we tried to put all of our eggs in that basket and have that be the source of our self-knowledge, because it doesn't give us ultimately what we want, which is immortality. And like you said, he doesn't give a prescription for the fear of death, the terror of death. His solution really is to learn to live with it. Learn to live with it. Very similar to the way Camus thinks we should answer the absurdism of life, which we will happily talk about how denial of death and absurdism from Camus tie in together when we get to Camus. But yeah, that's his answer, is there is no solution. Any solution that you try to partake of is not going to give you what you want deep down, which is immortality. So you're going to live with a kind of dissatisfaction. And that just has to do with the fact that you are going to die one day.
This paradox, quoting Ernest Becker, this is the paradox. He is out of nature and hopelessly in it. He is dual, up in the stars, and yet housed in a heart-pumping, breathing, gasping body that once belonged to a fish and still carries the gills. Marx to prove it. His body is a materially fleshy casting that is alien to him in many ways, the strangest and most repugnant way being that it arches and bleeds and will decay and die. Man is literally split in two. He has an awareness of his own splendid uniqueness, that he sticks out of nature with a towering majesty, and yet he goes back into the ground a few feet in order to blindly and dumbly rot and disappear forever. And that's just adding on to the way he's prescribing our view of ourselves unconsciously, whether we know it or not. Not saying he's right or wrong, but that we have this dual split of, wow, we're so majestic and we're so beautiful and we're so different. And if we look at religions, they often tried to answer these very difficult questions of humanity, of what do you do with the fact that you see older people than you dying, you see terrors of pain, suffering, and death. What is the meaning, and why should we keep striving? And one of the answers is that, well, man is different. Human is different. Judeo-Christian belief systems built on the idea that man is unique from animal, that they are created differently than animal and have more of a soul essence than an animal. And these are ways of answering why we're different or why we should have this type of ego development and understanding of what we consider our towering majesty over the rest of nature. And yet, even if we believe all these things, the empirical side of the evidence is we watch humans struggle with the terror of death and ultimately die without having any power to change the disappearing echoes of our life.
Yeah, he very poetically points out that paradox that we are of two natures in one. We're constantly going to deal with that contradiction. And so, you know, to my line of thinking, there's just an inevitable dissatisfaction we're always going to have. And looked at from an evolutionary lens, we have to have at our core a kind of dissatisfaction if we're going to be motivated to get anything done from a survival and propagation standpoint. But that we're more than just the body part, we're the mind, the spiritual side. And so that dissatisfaction, that hollow part, kind of reverberates through all the other parts of it. And we try to fill that with different things. And just living with that dissatisfaction, I think, is what he's talking about. But it's not all doom and gloom. He does point out that, you know, just looking at the sorrowful side of nature doesn't really help you get anywhere. You have to have hope. You have to use your ways of making meaning in the full unblinking realization that you are going to die. Use meaning making as a way to have hope and live within the things that you can control and you can affect. Again, we're blending a little bit of stoicism in there, but that's ultimately kind of what he points out. And this quote, you know, looking back through my notes, this one reminds me of what we were talking about earlier with Oscar Wilde's idea that, you know, life's too important to take seriously. So this is, again, from Ernest Becker. I think that taking life seriously means something such as this, that whatever man does on this planet has to be done in the lived truth of the terror of creation, of the grotesque, of the rumble of panic underneath everything. Otherwise, it is false. Whatever is achieved must be achieved from within the subjective energies of creatures, without deadening, with the full exercise of passion, of vision, of pain, of fear, and of sorrow. I think a much more poetic summary of his thoughts than what you and I can put together. I think that kind of covers it.
I did also want to address, although I and Leo enjoyed the book, I did want to bring up a few things in his writings that have been critiqued by people. So it won a Pulitzer Prize. It's broadly well-known, and it's very useful. And if you read through a lot of the criticisms people have about the book, I can kind of categorize them into three main summaries. The first one being easy, where we already talked about there's a non-prescriptive aspect to the book, where many people feel dissatisfied with his jutting that we have the terror of death and there's no answer, and they read it as a heading towards nihilism ideology. And there might be credence to those types of interpretations, but for the most part, I feel like there's plenty of evidence within the body of work that, yes, it's not prescriptive, but there's still the idea that you have your own autonomy as your own person to find answers yourself. So he doesn't give you a, here's the problem, here's the solution, but he says, here's the motivation for our actions, here's something to consider, and you have to deal with it. Which is a, in my opinion, true statement, that there is no prescriptive answer to this. And anyone trying to give you a prescriptive answer to the terror of death is trying to sell you something. And every human has to come up with their own answer, be that through family or self-meaning making or religion or anything else, that falls on the individual's responsibility.
Yeah, I think the critique of, you know, okay, well, where's the solution? You got these several hundred pages talking about how we're afraid of death. What's the solution? I think that critique is to miss the point. And there is, like you said, there is no solution. You have to live alongside that dissatisfaction, that fear. It's not going away. There's nothing that can make it go away in a real meaningful way. So those people are just did not understand the point of the book, in my opinion.
Yeah, but
what are the other critiques?
The second or third critiques I would put in a broad category, in a broad categorization, is that the writing itself is difficult and unobtainable. Many of the other critiques were along those lines.
That makes sense. But the nihilism, yeah, I never got a sense of nihilism from Becker. Everything, the overall impression, you know, it now having been a few months since I read the book, I did not feel more stressed or more nihilistic or anything from reading the book. And that might be me more than the book. I can understand how some people could have a more nihilistic viewpoint. I get that. It's not the takeaway that I had.
And I think part of the difficulty in the second broad category of critiques of this book add to that first one, where I can understand that it is a difficult read. And if you're not versed in psychoanalytical or academic terminology, it can be a little bit unattainable to pull from it. And not to take away from the beauty of Ernest Becker's works, it is difficult to ascertain. And I don't want people to feel lesser for having a hard time grappling with it, because even very intellectual people have a hard time grappling with these concepts. And some of them are rather pedantic due to him putting everything in through the lens of an academic psychoanalytic perspective, because he had his PhD and he was a professor. And so writing in that realm, sometimes you don't have the definitions for words that people in that field already have. So,
yeah, there was a lot of jargon. It is a difficult read, I will say for sure.
And so, not to take away from the book, but yes, there is some difficulty there, unless you are specifically an academic in that field. And the third broad categorization of critiques, compounding the second one, is that a lot of people complain about the structure built on the basis of psychoanalytic works, mostly from Freud. And I'll give a quote from the book itself here to kind of highlight that. Children feel hounded by symbols they don't understand the need of, verbal demands that seem picayune, and rules and codes of them that call them away from their pleasures and the straightforward expressions of their natural energies. And when they try to master the body, pretend it isn't there, act like a little man, the body suddenly overwhelms them, submerges them in vomit, and the child breaks down in despair over his melted pretense at being a purely symbolic animal. Often the creature deliberately soils himself or continues to wet the bed to protest against the imposition of artificial symbolic rules. He seems to be saying that the body is his primary reality and that he wants to remain in the simpler physical Eden and not be thrown out into the world of right and wrong.
A lot of Freud there.
Lots of Freud. And so that's going to be the third and final category of criticism I've seen a lot of people have for his work, is that it does build on Freud. He talks about mental disorders being derived from the inability to accept the reality of death. He talks about the Oedipus complex, seeing the menstrual blood of mothers being a difficult understanding of how we are worm food when we are children, how children respond in a sexual context based on Freud's work, and how that's all the humanliness of us rebelling against the symbolic animal that we are. And to answer that, yes, there are many elements of psychoanalytics that we would not necessarily appreciate as a whole in our current thought basis. And those criticisms are understandable. And yes, there are times in the book where I read, oh, the child soils themselves, and that's their rebelling against being a symbolic animal. When the child just soils itself.
Sometimes just going to the bathroom is just going to the bathroom.
Right. And on that level of criticism, I will agree that there are parts of the book that I'm like, okay, I just got to throw this piece away because I don't think we need to understand that a small child soiled itself as a symbolic rebelling against dying.
I guess I'm not really bothered so much by the Freudian stuff and the psychoanalytic stuff that I come across. It does lengthen the book unnecessarily and makes it kind of inaccessible. And a lot of the thinking is outdated. But when it just doesn't bother me when I went through the book and read that stuff. I was like, okay, this is not technically true, but seeing how we're going from thought A to thought B to thought C, seeing how the thought develops, seeing it in the larger context of when the book was written and how psychology has updated it since then, I found very useful and insightful. And while I don't think there's a lot of stuff that Freud thought and his followers thought that we still kind of hold to nowadays, that doesn't mean what they did is wasted effort, and it doesn't mean that it's not worthwhile, at least in my opinion, to interact with their thoughts and their writings, because these were obviously very intelligent people who genuinely wanted to make progress and build the science of psychology at the time. And yeah, to me, it's useful to look at that stuff, just not necessarily accurate.
Right. And the reason I wanted to bring up these criticism is to give a holistic overview of the book. I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and there's a lot we can pull from it. And I now, and in the future, will remain positive in the light of things. But in the spirit of positivity, growing, and learning, I do believe sometimes we have to have a critical view of things as well, and be able to point out and appreciate the negative sides of works or things that happen.
Yeah, we want to take a critical view of things and not just, you know, the books we like, just like, oh, this is perfect. There's no faults.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to conclude kind of my feelings on these, and I wanted to point out these criticisms because I still think this is a worthwhile book. It's very useful, and there's many things to derive out of it. But if you haven't read it and are thinking about reading it, I would recommend it. And I will say there are those three criticisms that are present within the book, and several of the Freudian base thoughts and philosophies that he developed are there. But like you were saying, I still appreciate the historical context. But just know that some things are not objectively true in the way that they're written.
Right. Right. That's a good warning. Yes, I would say the same thing. I would recommend reading it with the caveat you have to be okay with it being difficult. It's long, it's wordy. You have to read some things over a few times. You might have to go look up the Wikipedia page for some thinker that he references and get a broader view of their thought or philosophy, because he brings in many, 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 many thinkers and writers and philosophers, which is something I appreciate, but it does slow down the process of understanding what he's talking about. You bringing up these critiques of this book reminds me of kind of the broader context of book club in general. You know, oftentimes in the in-person book club that we do, the thoughts expressed pretty often that, oh, this is not a book I would have read on my own, or, you know, this is a book that I would have started and given up on if we weren't discussing it. And I think one of the, for me, we call it a book club, but I think really what it is, it's a discussion club. We just happen to read books. And like the best part of reading some of these more difficult books is the discussions we get to have out of it. And that kind of, for me, at least solidifies the takeaways from the book. Like there's Ernest Becker's Denial of Death is a perfect example, because there's no way that I would have had as much meaningful, practical takeaways from the book had I not discussed it every week that I was reading it with other intelligent people grappling with the same thoughts, you know, having multiple brains every week looking at the same difficult text over and over again, and all of us, you know, sitting around a table talking about it. That's what gave me the practical, meaningful takeaways, not so much my solo engagement with the book. So yeah, good warnings.
Yeah. And I hope that through the next several episodes, as we go through things, we want to give you the good parts of a book, but also the bad parts in a book as a whole. So I wish to show a representation of my understanding of the book itself and hopefully synthesize useful pieces both for us and for you as the listener.
Yeah, we're having a conversation here, the two of us, but for those of you listening, that's really what I'm looking forward to, is all of us participating in a larger conversation, engaging with these books, and then, you know, as we get to a spot where we can concurrently be reading a book and discussing it, I think that'll be where the real magic will happen. I want to get to the point where once the podcast gets going, we can participate as a group and each week go through comments and feedback people have, questions they may have about the book, and go from there.
And with that, I want to say, if you have any thoughts or feelings on this book, if you've already read it, if you're currently reading it, I would love to hear your opinion of it. I would love to hear your candid understanding of it and anything you agree or disagree with that we've said here. You can send that to us via email, and that'll be deepdivebookclubpodcast@gmail.com, I think. Let's check that real quick. And we also have a Instagram page, Deep Dive Book Club. And if you send us a message or send us anything, I would truly love to hear your thoughts and opinions. If you would like to have any input on stuff we're about to read or read it with us, please follow us there. And with that, Leo's checking to make sure I have the right email.
deepdivebookclub@gmail.com.
deepdivebookclub@gmail.com, which will be added to the show notes. Anything else you have before we close this out?
Nope. We'll talk to you guys next episode.
Next episode, we'll be here. And do we know what we're reading?
Not yet.
All right. Well, we'll announce it and then we'll talk about it. All right. If you've tuned in, thanks so much and have a wonderful time. And I hope that you go off today thinking about how you can enjoy the small moments of life and have a little question of how many more times will you be doing what you're doing?